Maybe their shots having special sales of these.
Are they?
That's quarter, half price or something like that. It's very, very.
These, the recorders?
No, the cassette.
Oh, the cassettes. Yeah. Oh, well, I should.
And the recorders, too, but.
Okay. That's good. Okay, we can. Well, you wanted to tell us about Wood?
I thought of the Wood. This was related to me by R.W. Wood back in in the early 20s. It was when he was a student in Germany. He complained to his housekeeper that the chicken soup she gave him for lunch was made from the bones of the chicken that she had the night before. Now, I always tell this story when I tell him about flame tests, the sodium giving you yellow and the barium giving you the green and the red for strontium and the deep red for lithium and so on. And he said, he complained, ah, 90, this is ganz frisch, very fresh chicken. Now, he said, you took the bones, you boiled them up, and they're in the soup for lunch here. 99. So, Otto, as a student, took out a little alcohol burner, lighted it, took out a little platinum wire on a glass rod, dipped the wire into the soup, held it in the hot flame, and beautiful dark red lithium flame shot up. He says, yesterday, before you took those bones out into the kitchen, I sprinkled some lithium chloride on the bones, and here they're in the soup today. Now, I also tell when I tell that when Ina Witak explosion took place, I marched down in front of the students. We were talking about photo light in that time, and I held the New York Times up in front of them and said, "Gentlemen, and." Hydrogen bomb has been exploded in Ina Witak today. Well, it wasn't released to the public for 3 weeks. And the boys thought it was wonderful. The professor had broken the code. Mm-hmm. And what it was, on the front page, it told how this sailor had said, I had seen 3 atom bomb explosions, but this was the first one when there was a dull red glow in the sky for 15 minutes after the bomb went off. My gentlemen, that can be only one thing. That's lithium hydride, actually it was lithium deuteride, a hydrogen bomb was exploded. That was my lithium story. Now, oh, I'll tell you an interesting thing about coming down. I was out, I don't think I told you this story. This is about Bodenstein and Nernst. Mm-hmm. I was in Minneapolis for the whole year, and I learned to blow glass pretty well. And Bonhoeffer was coming over to the American Chemical Society meeting that September and demonstrate how he and Hartek had discovered autopower hydrogen, mm-hmm. That the nuclei can rotate together or in opposite directions. And he would have gotten a Nobel Prize for it, I rather believe so. If it hadn't been that 2 years later, Urey discovered heavy hydrogen and sort of got the spotlight. And, mm-hmm. But Langmuir, for example, said when Bonhoeffer and Hartek discovered this, it was predicted by mathematics. And then they went into the laboratory and confirmed it and said this was the first example where 100% prediction by mathematics had led to a discovery that probably would not have been discovered in a laboratory for 100 years. So Bonhoeffer came over to Minneapolis to the September meeting of the ACS to display this. And he sent a very elaborate glass apparatus he wanted to used for displaying it. And Lynn said to me, why don't you do it for him, Hubert? You're a good glass boss. On a California desk, I blew the whole thing. And what Bonhoeffer was going to do was he's going to have the hydrogen at room temperature with auto power ratio of 3-1 passed down through carbon at liquid air temperatures. And the carbon would catalyze this change to 1-1, and you'd now have a different ratio of the auto and the power hydrogen. And then as it came up, they would measure its conductivity. And the conductivity before it passed through the charcoal at liquid air temperature and after it would be different. Hmm. And so up on the wall they saw the meter projected, and he said, now Dr. Allier will turn the stopcock so the hydrogen will go through the liquid charcoal and at the liquid air temperature, and we'll change it to 1-1. He changed it, and the dial moved across, and the mighty cheer went up. Well, now, at that meeting was Bodenstein from the University of Berlin, and he got up and gave a little paper in which he said he proposed a new name. And he said, now, When you have an Avogadro's number of particles, that's called a mole. If you have an Avogadro's particle of electrons, that's called one farady. He says, I propose that if you have an Avogadro's number of photons, we call them an Einstein. Hmm. It never did take, as a matter of fact, but mine was the very next paper, and I was discussing yield per photon. Mm-hmm. But I quickly shifted gears, and all through my paper, for the next 15 minutes, I talked about yield per Einstein. Whereupon, Bodenstein is laughing, jolly fellow, sort of like Dubai. Everybody loved that. Henry Eyring. In fact, I think the three of them all pour from the same mole, and Arrhenius, too. Arrhenius holding aloft a whiskey, and Ari holding aloft a jug of a Book of the Mormon, and Dubai holding aloft a calculator. So when I finished my talk, Dubai jumped up and grinned out over the audience and said, I never realized or believed that my suggestion of 15 minutes ago would lead to such immediate international acceptance. Well, now, so I knew Bodenstein. So here I'm going over to Halber. A few weeks later, I'm in Germany, and I have a letter from Taylor to Nernst, just to see him. And Nernst was a big, pompous sort of guy, the typical Geheimrat with all the privy docents, young people working and running around, waiting for him to die so they could sit in that overstuffed chair. and now he and Haber hated one another because it all arises from the fact that Haber became fabulously wealthy with the ammonia process based on Lenz's third law. So Lenz, though he got a Nobel Prize, Lenz did, he was still a poor college professor, and Haber was a multimillionaire. And they hated each other so much so that I often would go out to the scientific meetings of Haber, at the Benson Gesellschaft, for example. And he would call up and make sure that Nernst was not going to the meeting, because if it were, he wouldn't go. Hmm. So it was just terrible rivalry. And it originated from when Haber was a young man, and he made a miscalculation using Nernst's theorem. And I think it was a Calder, I'm not quite sure. At that meeting, Haber got up, a young man he was, in 1907, and apologized that he had made a miscalculation. 3 hours later, Nernst got up and lambasted this stupid young fellow that misused my things and made these mistakes, although Haber had publicly apologized for it. From that minute on, they hated one another. Mm-hmm. So I walked in to Nernst at the university. And right around the corner was Bodenstein's office. They're both professors of chemistry. And I walked in, and he and Nernst were the ones who had done the photochemistry chain reaction back in 1914, so I was very closely connected to them. I walked in and gave this letter from Hugh Taylor to Nernst, introducing me. And he sunk back into his chair, and he said, "And with whom are you working?" Well, I was wise enough not to say Fritz Haber. So I had him say, "Hello." I said, "Well, I have just been in and paid my respects to Max Bodenstein." "Bodenstein, ist gut. He sunk back into his chair and continued the conversation for an hour. That was my meeting with Nernst. Nernst always began by saying his lecture on third law. The first law of thermodynamics, everybody knows. The second law of thermodynamics, very few very intelligent chemists know. The third law of thermodynamics, nobody knows but myself. I invented it.
I'm honest man.
All right, I guess it's something I often see what next you're going to say. Einstein, I guess I better tell you about Einstein now, shall I?
Sure.
I was there at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute with Haber, and Einstein was one of the directors of the institute. Mm-hmm. And he came to visit visit Haber one day, and Haber brought him down to see my instrument. I haven't told you this, have I? It was an interferometer. It was a very complex instrument that I had, and one part of it was an interferometer, a long tube, 20 feet long. At one end, there were two lenses, and they lighted up, and you twisted them until the two lenses lights were of equal intensity. And then you could read the percentage of oxygen in this long tube. And so Haber comes in with Einstein, and Einstein immediately goes to the wrong end of the tube, not where the lenses are, but 20 feet away where they're just pipes. And he bends over and he gets the pipes and he's looking at them and looking at them and looking at them. And I say to the teacher, now, what would most of us have done? We would have been ashamed to show our ignorance. We'd have said, very interesting, but then walked away. But not Einstein. He wasn't afraid to show it. He says, it's a garbage dream. I can't see anything. He says, oh, on this side of here, Professor, on this side of Geheimrat. And it bent down and showed me, and he twisted the lens and looked up and he says, wunderbar. And I tell the teachers, that's something I learned that day from Einstein, that every teacher should tell his students, never be ashamed to show your ignorance once, rather than remain ignorant all your life. Mm-hmm. Well, then he came to Princeton. And there at Princeton, he came out to some of my lectures. The first lecture came out, he came up and thanked me for it. And I said, Geheimrat, you perhaps do remember, you met me in Fritz Haber's lab. And yeah, you remembered then. But I was very polite not to recall that he looked through the wrong end. Now, the story I'm going to tell you about, when he came to my lectures, he always sat about two-thirds of the way back over on my right side, your right. And I always say this big shock of white hair standing out amongst the crowd. And you get to know your audience. Feedback from your audience is very important. And I would say something, and that white shock of hair would just still. He hadn't understood. So I'd say it a different way, and still. And I'd say it a different way, and still. Say it a fourth way. Then the hair would glob up and down, and then I'd go on to something else, because I figured out Einstein understood it, everybody did. Now I'll tell you a story about Freddy, my little son. When he was under three, about 2.5 years old, I bought a huge number of Fortune magazines. They were $1 a copy. That was a lot in those days, but I got them for a nickel a piece, secondhand New York. They had beautiful colored pictures that you couldn't buy in those days. Easily. And I cut up these pictures, art pictures and things, on the thought that if Freddie saw these when he was little, it would make him interested in art. Now, I'm not sure about what it is, because though he's a PhD in chemical engineering, very interested in artistic ancient things of this kind. And so when he was 3 years old, I made a very thick scrapbook with all these pictures from Fortune magazine. And one picture was the entire page was a picture of Einstein, who was teaching out at Caltech that year, about 1937 it would have been. And the picture filled the page, and Einstein's hair was all on end, and Freddie thought it was a woman. He used to call it Mrs. Einstein. So he was hypnotized by this picture of Mrs. Einstein. And we had a regular routine every night. We'd sit, Freddie in his pajamas, ready to bed, and we'd start looking at these pictures. And he'd look at another one. And just before we got to Einstein, to tease him, I'd say, now we're going to go to bed. Then he knew Daddy was pretty. He'd look up and grin and says, no, I want to see Mrs. Einstein. So I'd open it up and he'd look and he'd see it, and then he'd toddle off to bed. Well, a few months later, Einstein moved to Princeton. And he, in those days, the institute wasn't built. He worked at the mathematics building, Fine Hall, and then he would walk past where we lived on his way home for lunch. And one day, Freddie was playing, stopped playing and gazed down the street, and here came Einstein along, the hair blowing in the wind, just like out of that kind. So he got no further away than, Fivey, about as far away as you are, Dad. And then his little baby voice says, Daddy, is that Mrs. Einstein with the big hair? And Einstein bowed and said, yes, that's Mrs. Einstein, young man. Now, we liked children, and Evelyn took Freddie down to the golf course. There's a little brook there, one of the hazards, and Freddie would push little boats into it. And then they'd go down and pick them up further down. Well, the path on the other side led from Einstein's home. And one day, Einstein was walking past. He used to watch the children there. Freddie was playing with his boat, and he stopped in front and watched Freddie, and Freddie pushed the boat and got on Einstein's side of the brook, caught in the weeds. And Einstein got down on one knee and pushed the boat back to Freddie. Well, Freddie knew Mrs. Einstein, so he pushed the back boat to the land, and Einstein pushed it back to Freddie, and Freddie really, I think he was studying Freddie's reaction to it. And back and forth they pushed it 3 or 4 times. I said, just think, Freddie, when you get to be an old man. And they say, Grampy, did you ever know Einstein? He said, oh, sure. I used to play boats with him. Barbara Rom, a professional violinist, later was the first violinist out in San Francisco, lived here at Princeton, and when Einstein came, she organized a quartet, because Einstein played the violin. Since Barbara was a professional, she played first violin. She used to say, "I never thought I would live to see the day when Einstein played second fiddle to me." Another newspaper man told me how they're walking down the street to one of them, two newspaper men flanking Einstein on Nassau Street. They came from the drugstore. Einstein said, "Excuse me a minute." And he went in and he leaned over the counter and whispered to the druggist. The druggist disappeared and came back with something wrapped in paper and gave it to Einstein. And Einstein came out and he bent over it and he bent over it. It was an ice cream cone. And you have to hide it. You couldn't, if he walked down licking the ice cream cone, like someone would have photographed him. When we were in Berlin, he used to sail a great deal on Wannsee. And one day, followed by a motorboat of photographers, and one day he capsized. And the next day, Berlin Zeitung, the front page, the entire page filled with a picture of Einstein, and a big Einstein collapses on Einstein. One day the phone rang, and the boy said, "I would like to have Professor Einstein's phone number, please." And she said, "I'm sorry, it's an unlisted number." Oh, she said, "But I need to have it." He said, "Sorry, we are not allowed to give out unlisted numbers." So, "Will you please tell me where Professor Einstein lives?" "No, sir, I'm sorry, we cannot give that." "But I must know." "Why must you know?" "I'm Professor Einstein." He'd moved there a couple of weeks before and forgotten where he lived. And very wisely, the phone operator gave him Dean Eisenhardt's phone number, and Eisenhardt's 12-year-old son came and got Einstein and took him home.
That's a good story. I hadn't heard that one before.
Let me see what else. He tailed it. That was funny. In 1931, Urey announced heavy water. When Iron came and worked with Taylor a great deal in 31 actually, too, it was, because it was 31 that this happened, they began to make a lot of heavy water. And there in Princeton, we made more heavy water than any other place in the world. And Taylor then was elected. I'm not sure at that time he was head of the... maybe the Faraday Society. Anyway, he was head of one of the larger British, and he was to give the honorary address. And they met in the laboratory, in the library, for dinner, where Cavendish, the discoverer of hydrogen, had discovered hydrogen in 1781. Now, I read hydrogen was discovered in 1776, but 1781 is the one I always had in mind. Anyway, and so Cavendish belonged to the Royal Society and the Faraday Society, and every Thursday he used to come to it. He was rather non-communicative. He never allowed women servants to appear in his presence. If they did, he would discharge them. And in this particular case, but every Thursday he attended this meeting. And that meeting, he hung his hat on the same peg. One year he hung it 53 times, it being 53 Thursdays that year. And Taylor sat around with all these famous people, and he got up and he held aloft a test tube full of heavy water. And he said, "Just exactly 150 years ago, that's why it's 1931, Cavendish rose from this same table and announced the discovery of hydrogen. I announce here is more heavy water than in any other place in the world. We just brought it from Princeton, and we're going to continue research with it." Yes, Derry?
I wasn't on the phone.
No, you tell him to call back at 5 o'clock. Well, I tell him I can't do it. You have to call him tomorrow. That's all we recorded.
We can erase them. We can stop for a minute.
No, you can't. They can call. This happens all day long. If it's important enough, he'll call again. If it's not important, well, we're with him. No, we're going to record. And so he said, 150 years ago today, around this same table, Cavendish announced the discovery of hydrogen. I announced the heavy hydrogen. Now he was to come back, bring this heavy hydrogen with him. And he got to the New York Customs, and the Because I said, what's in there? And he said, water.
Sure.
Well, this went on and on. Yes, water. Well, finally they called up down to Princeton. Do you have a dean here who has water that he brings it? Oh, yes, that's Dean Taylor with heavy water. So that's how he got the heavy water through New York Customs. turn it off, I'll tell you about the time. This is a...
How long did you know Harold Urey in those days?
I didn't know Urey. Urey?
Yes.
I didn't know him very well. Whenever he came down to Princeton, I would see him. But he was at Columbia, you know. And he'd come down. I met him any number of times, but I didn't know him very well. So I can't help you much about that.
How about Henry Eyring?
Henry Eyring. I'll tell you a lot about Henry Eyring. Now, I'm a spot for Henry Eyring coming to Princeton.
Oh.
This is the way it happened. He was working with Polanyi, and I was working with Haber there at the Heisenberg Institute. So we got to know each other and our wives and family very, very well that year. Had dinners together. I don't know when this happened. I've got to go to the archives to find exactly where this happened. It was either Chicago or Indianapolis. I'm not sure when the American Chemical Society met. And I went to them that September. After I came back, I went to the American Chemical Society meeting, and Henry had returned to Berkeley from Germany. And Henry came to me and said, Hubert, he says, I'm looking for a job. I said, there's no job in Berkeley, and I don't know where I can go. So immediately I went to Hugh Taylor. I said, hey, Henry Eyring is a wonderful guy, just a wonderful guy, and we ought to nab him. And I said, he's going to give a speech in a few minutes, and I said, I'll go hear him. He came back and said, have him come and give the same speech to Princeton. Yeah. So I went to him and I said, Henry, it was either from Indianapolis or Chicago. That's what I have to check before. I write to his the memos out of Utah they want me to write about. I said, Henry, we're going to pay your way to Princeton and back here again, and we'll give you an honorarium. I forget what it was. He said, that's fine. He came and he never left Princeton. He telephoned to Mildred and said, come on to Princeton. They offered me a job as an instructor. And that was out of 1931, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And he stayed on until the wartime. I forget when he left for Princeton. But it was a good 15 years or so he stayed.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went out there as a dean.
Yeah.
Now, I'll tell you a funny story about Henry. just a wonderful person.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was always going to work. Quantum mechanics solved anything you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Until you got down to the nitty-gritty, and then there's some hard bumps. We're not quite ready to handle something like that. But he was a wonderful person to work with, Hugh Taylor. Taylor with a tremendous imagination, and Henry with a sound mathematical treatment in quantum mechanics. Together they made an extremely fine mm-hmm. pair and published a lot of very interesting material.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them contributed equally. It wasn't entirely Henry. I say Hugh Taylor was a catalyst for Henry.
Mm-hmm.
No question of that. The two of them worked wonderfully together. And everything Henry did was perfect. He really was a wonderful, wonderful person. Somebody said to know him was to know a university. Well, I'm going to tell you about time he was absent-minded. He was up. He talked up at, I think it was NYU, no. Brooklyn Polytech. He was talking at Brooklyn Polytech. Now, the year before, he had talked at Brooklyn Polytech, and he hadn't gotten home until midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I'll come and talk, but you've got to get me to the train on time so I can get home at 11 o'clock at night, because I'll get home at midnight. Well, they were so intent on getting to the train, they drove him by all the way over from Brooklyn over to the station and got him there 10 minutes before the train left. And so Henry rushed down and jumped on the train, and the man didn't come through the ticket until they had passed Newark. The man took one look and says, well, this train doesn't stop at Princeton Junction, the first stop at Trenton. He'd gotten on 5 minutes earlier on the express and said, well, when it stopped at Princeton. So he gets to Trenton, he says, when does the next train go back? Well, it's going back in hour and a quarter. So he sat there at Trenton for an hour and a quarter and got on the train. Look at this train doesn't stop at Princeton Junction. First stop, Newark. chapter there. Well, I don't know, it was 5 o'clock or something like that. And he finally got home the same day or the next day.
That's good. I can sympathize with that. He's, since I commute every day now. But well, did you have much of a chance, or, I mean, you and Iring and the others must have had a chance to talk kinetics. I mean, what were his scientific views like? What was it like to deal with him as a chemist?
Everything that he had, he reduced to mathematical formulas and equations, and handled them beautifully so you could understand what he's doing. He actually gave lectures, quantum mechanics. They were so intelligent, and Wigner did too, that when I went to Hawaii, I gave a course in quantum mechanics based on what had been taught me, you see. But I never really used it in my research. I can't tell you too much about it.
Was Kistiakowsky was at Princeton for a couple of years then, too?
I will never forget. Oh, I knew Kistiakowsky very well. First, when he first arrived, he had worked with Bodenstein, see, the photochemist, you see. He came here. When he arrived in New York on a boat, Hugh Taylor met him. And as they started driving toward Princeton, he said, "What time will we get to Princeton tomorrow?" "Oh," he tells her, "we'll get there in about 2 hours." "And hours?" "Yeah." Well, he said, "I looked up Princeton. It's Princeton, Indiana." Well, he was a remarkable glassblower. He could take quartz, which melts, the point at which quartz begins to melt and becomes liquid is only 60 degrees or something like that, and you have to be a fantastic glass blower to build quartz spirals and things like that. A professional glass blower can't do them all, but George could do it, you see. So when he arrived, he got married shortly after he arrived here, and they had a lot of Vera. And last spring I was having lunch with a lady who's the head of Cal State out at Fullerton. And we happened to say something about Kistiakowsky. He says, "Oh, I knew his daughter Vera very well," she said. "Vera, his daughter, is up at massive MIT. I have a wonderful booklet, the history of Kistiakowsky, that Danton wrote for the Royal Society. It's upstairs or somewhere. If you want to copy, want to take it away and then send it back to me after you photostat it. So I said to the president, I said, "You know, next time you talk with Vera, you tell him that you had lunch with a man who held her in his arms for a whole hour when she was 2 weeks old." I used to babysit for them every once in a while. And George was writing a photochemistry book. And while his chemistry was perfect, his English had something to be desired, and I helped him. And in the book, that was the first time my name ever appeared in print, he thanked me for it. Well, now he passed forward and he was, you read it, they quote me quite a bit in this thing, so you don't need to have me say it again. But one thing I didn't say, I'll never forget the time he came down from Harvard, the day that Germany invaded Russia. And he backed against the wall there in the corridor, and just the two of them, and he said, "Hubert, we are now going to live in an armed camp for the rest of our lives." He's very prosthetic about it. And now what it tells upstairs there is the story of, this starts, my top, all my top stuff is because of George Kistiakowsky. At least he did the seeding that grew into the top. I got a letter from him in 1947. He said, "Hubert," he said, "you won't believe, he is now chairman of the department there at Harvard." And he had been voted by the Harvard faculty. Are you going to change it?
Yeah, just one second.